Good morning. Welcome to what is the beginning of a really, really interesting and exciting experiment for some of us. Had my oats this morning. That's great. I seem to have become the designated introducer of Nathan George. But it's a great privilege because he's such a friend to First Press Berkeley. I met Nathan in 2007, and I think right around that time he also came here to First Press. I know I'd had breakfast with Mark Laverton, and he was so excited about this man who had a vision for making purchasing decisions count in the alleviation of poverty. And they'd just come from a meeting with Nathan and I believe Dave Matstone and maybe a few others. And they were just on the threshold of some very exciting beginnings. But before that, Nathan was just going about his life back in the early part of the turn of the century, business developer for a software company based in the UK. He and Kat and their three boys lived in a village outside of London, and he spent maybe 50% of his time in the air on long-haul flights to India, or Asia generally, the US, Europe, building his career. And somehow the Lord began to speak to him about the intersection of faith and what he was doing with his life as a man of faith, as a follower of Jesus. And he and Kat began long discussions about this and met and became good friends with Paul Chambers, the head of Tradecraft, Paul Chandler, head of Tradecraft, the largest fair trade organization in the UK, and then Kim Tan and Mike Perot and the fellows at Transformational Business Network became good friends, and pretty soon he and Kat were making trips to Africa and India, and visited actually 25 different businesses right on the ground, working to create jobs, gainful employment for people at the lowest levels, and especially those who had been caught up in sex trafficking and in HIV, with HIV, AIDS, and just the poorest of the poorest, the most desperate, and God continued to work on their heart. He continued to ask the question, this is a big question, how can we help? How can I help? And unanimously, every one of them said, we need a route to the market in America, and we need you to tell our story. And that's... So what more natural thing than for Nathan to say, Kat, boys, let's move to Santa Cruz. And actually, they started in Sunnyvale and on the peninsula, working out of their home. In 2006, they founded Trade as One. And what more natural thing to do than to establish a company that says, here's a fair wage. We buy products from people who are being paid a fair wage. And I have found in Nathan a person who is so full of grace and truth. It's not about coming and laying a guilt trip on us. It's not even for inspiration, but it's that practical, it's kind of that American can-do thing that he's reintroduced us to, of what can we do? What can we do? Last night, Kellen and I saw the most fabulous movie, and you've got to see it, just out, Beasts of the Southern Wild. Beasts of the Southern Wild. And it's set in the Louisiana Delta, a little place called the Bathtub. And this little girl, this six-year-old girl, is the narrator and the actor. She's not prepared. But anyway, it's just amazing. But in all of this thought of how do we, what do we, what do our actions have to do with the bigger universe? Toward the very end, she says, "Well, when you're small, you just have to fix what you can." And listening to Charlie Rose the other day with Bill Gates, there was this humility in Bill Gates that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, we think billions, still very small. When you're small, you have to fix what you can. What can we do? And this, I think, is just an ingenious way to make us more aware, this hungry for change, of adjusting our diet for a few days to become physically, in the physicality of who we are, aware of others. I'm so glad to introduce our friend Nathan George. And every time I've listened to Nathan, I've heard him a few times, it's always something new, always some new insight. And Nathan, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob. Well, it's great to be back. I will shake your hands afterwards, but please be gentle. I spent all of yesterday, from the moment I woke up to the moment I went to sleep, tearing apart my kitchen and trying to put things back together again. So in this vain attempt to save money, and it was above all things, and I completely forgot that yesterday was our wedding anniversary in doing so. So I've got bruises and cuts and all sorts of things, so be gentle when you shake my hands. Kath and I have now been happily married for 20 years. We've actually been married for 22. happily for 20 of those. and it's great to be back. And on the day when you guys are starting Hungry for Change as well. When Kath and I went through this, it actually changed a lot of things about us and what we do. So I'm really hoping that as you just get into the rhythms of hunger three times a day, and some people actually, bizarrely, having gone through it, say they don't feel hungry. I don't really understand that. We definitely did. And as your body kind of gets into those rhythms, what I found is that rather than, and what I've always done in the past in fasting, is do a 24-hour fast. Doing it as an extended fast over 5 days is very, very different, and you get into a dialogue with God that's more sustained over a period of time than trying to cram a fast into 24 hours. It changed the way Kath and I eat and what we prepare for our kids now. It's changed a lot of things. They're actually pretty worried that we might turn vegetarian. What I didn't expect, I lost 5 pounds on this thing. I didn't expect it. I went on to lose another 5 after kind of just eating more healthily. But it just made us realize that, and I think this is why Jesus takes the side of the poor. It's not to condemn us rich, but it's to invite us into fellowship together, because there are gifts to be given on both sides. And for us, the gift was much more simplicity in how we go about feeding ourselves, and looking at a bunch of things in our lives. And I think that's the gift the poor have to bring us, is to simplify our lives. And oddly enough, just eating simple, wholesome food has been a huge gift to us. So I really hope that those of you who are taking part, and I know you're going to be starting at different times. Bob's already started this morning. I think most of you starting tonight. But I've gone through this a couple of times myself, and I've had to shift when I start it because I'm traveling. Whenever you do this, I really hope and pray that you find it a really deeply meaningful experience. Allows God to work through you. So I was asking, it's interesting, I saw a friend of mine who's on staff at Menlo Park Pres. They came to stay with us last weekend, I think it was, and we got into a long conversation in the evening over the barbecue, and they said, "Well, what are the of all the churches you've been to in America? Which are the top six that you? Where would you put the top six? Who are the top six churches that you feel are aligned with your message and are participating and partnering with you?" And it, without any question, First Pres Berkeley was number one. And actually, after mentioning you, your guy's name, I kind of went, "And there's not really others that do it anywhere close to as well as First Pres Berkeley." You know, you guys have this humility, this hunger for God, for the ways of God, and it expresses itself in you know, looking at issues of justice, looking at issues of poverty, looking at issues of discipleship in following Jesus. As I travel around the country and partner with lots of churches, I see a lot of consumer Christianity out there. I mean, that is the dominant message or way in which churchianity is done, and basically it is putting us at the center of our little universe and providing programs and putting on a rock show and having a rock star preacher to stroke your egos or to give you some therapeutic program. It's basically consumerism put into church guys. It's interesting, I was at a conference in Mount Hermon with Mark Labberton. He was giving the keynote about 3 weeks ago, and he made this observation that, and you may have already heard it from him anyway, but that we become what we look at. And we look at our culture so much, our church just reflects that. And so, you know, it, really interestingly, I was at a church that, around about 15,000 in size, and you know, I went up to one of the pastors while I was there and just said, "Please help me with this. And don't take this the wrong way, but this is just consumer Christianity, right? This is what you guys do." And I find it so difficult to match the challenge of a radical first century rabbi with what we're doing in churches like this. How do you put consumerism and Christianity together? I think they are completely antithetical. And he said, "Well, it's really easy. What we do is we use consumerism for the gospel, right? So you put on a show and you give therapeutic programs, so the gospel then gets into people's lives that way." And I thought that was a really profound observation about what the gospel actually is. And I'm getting into more of a dialogue with this guy around, really, let's unpack the gospel then, if you think that consumerism is the way to introduce it. So, you know, and we, you know, Traders One can do very well with churches that are that type. We, you know, we'll go and we'll do a big event, but we find that after you've done it once, you will not get an email or a voicemail returned ever again, because they did the fair trade thing. Now we're going to go and solve the orphan crisis, and then next year we're going to solve HIV, and we move on. But our partnership with you has been over a number of years and has evolved, and it's just so fantastic to see you putting teaching together of live simply, give generously, and buy ethically, together with, you know, the calls to action. So I'm very, very grateful for this church. And we were founded, Traders One was founded, not to be just another fair trade company, but to be a catalytic tool for the church to allow the kingdom to start to invade our lives into areas that we've capitulated to culture. And nowhere more so than when you look at this whole realm of our money, right, our income. And because the standard message around money in churches is you need to give more, you need to give to God. And let's talk about tithing. I mean, 2.8%, Barna studies show about 2.8% of people's income is given to the church. So we're not even meeting Old Testament standards. And actually, Old Testament standards, if you look at all the tithe laws, should be closer to 23%. But anyway, let's not talk about it. Most people think it's 10. We're not even meeting 10%. So the message the church has around money and income is just give more, right? But only once or twice have I heard it preached from the pulpit what the gospel has to do with the other 97%. And we completely abandon all discipleship questions, issues, or thought leadership to culture for that 97%. And we become what we look at. We become what is advertised to us. And of course, we know that advertising is essentially feeding either fear or greed. So I think this whole area of what does the Bible have to say about living more simply, about letting go and giving more generously, and about buying ethically, putting justice, compassion, mercy into our microeconomic decisions. I think this area is, I could spend the rest of my life, I feel, kind of unpacking this area, and it would not be enough. So today, I know you guys have gone through live simply and give generously. I want to focus more on buy ethically piece. And as we do, I don't know if anybody, have people seen the Story of Stuff video by Annie Lennox? Yep, you have. I just want to show, and I just want to show like a just under a 2-minute clip from this really good educational video that takes a look at the whole process of how stuff gets made, marketed, and then bought, and then consumed, and then disposed of, because it's a linear, it's not a cyclical thing, right? Just to start to tee up our thinking around how consumerism affects us and how we go about our daily lives.
Started with shoes. Advertisements and media in general plays a big role in this. Each of us in the U.S. is targeted with over 3,000 advertisements a day. We see more advertisements in 1 year than people 50 years ago saw in a lifetime. And if you think about it, what's the point of an ad except to make us unhappy with what we have? So 3,000 times a day, we're told our hair is wrong, our skin is wrong, our clothes are wrong, our furniture is wrong, our car is wrong, we are wrong, but it can all be made right if we just go shopping. Media also helps by hiding all of this and all of this. So the only part of the materials economy we see is the shopping. The extraction, production, and disposal all happens outside of our field of vision. So in the U.S., we have more stuff than ever before. But polls show that our national happiness is actually declining. Our national happiness peaked in the 1950s, the same time that this consumption mania exploded. Interesting coincidence. I think I know why. We have more stuff, but we have less time for the things that really make us happy. Friends, family, leisure time. We're working harder than ever. Some analysts say we have less leisure time than any time since feudal society. And do you know what the two main activities are that we do with the scant leisure time we have? Watch TV and shop. In the U.S., we spend 3 to 4 times as many hours shopping as our counterparts in Europe do. So we're in this ridiculous situation where we go to work, maybe 2 jobs even, and we come home and we're exhausted, so we plop down on our new couch and watch TV, and the commercials tell us, you suck, so you gotta go to the mall to buy something to feel better, and then you gotta go to work more to pay for the stuff you just bought, so you come home and you're more tired, so you sit down and you watch more TV, and it tells you to go to the mall again, and we're on this crazy work, watch, spend treadmill, and we could just stop.
Would you mind turning the lights back up again for me? Thank you. Another thing that is mentioned in that Story of Stuff video is this quote by a 20th century economist and retail analyst, which is worth reading out, actually. Our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life, that we convert the buying and use of goods into rituals, that we seek our spiritual satisfaction, our ego satisfaction in consumption. The measure of social status, I think you say, status, of social change, I'm still learning, of social acceptance, of prestige, is now to be found in our consumptive patterns. The very meaning and significance of our lives today is expressed in consumptive terms. The greater the pressures upon the individual to conform to safe and accepted social standards, the more does he tend to express his aspirations and his individuality in terms of what he wears, drives, eats, his home, his car, his pattern of food servings, his hobbies. These commodities and services must be offered to the consumer with a special urgency. We need things consumed, burned up, worn out, replaced, and discarded at an ever-increasing pace. We need to have people eat, drink, dress, ride, live with ever more complicated and therefore constantly more expensive consumption. So that was at around about 1950 when he came. That could be exactly what we've ended up at today. So consumer culture is one of the most powerful systems of formation that we know. I think it is actually in the way in which we practice Christianity more powerful in terms of shaping our formation than Christian practice. We spend 1 or 2 hours a week in Bible study or prayer or coming to church. If you're really good, maybe you spend 3 or 4. And you consider how much time we are bombarded with advertising message and in that system of consumption. I was shocked coming to America. I couldn't get over. I couldn't even fill up my car with gas without being marketed to and shouted at. It's just like America has it in a way that no other country I've visited has it. It is extraordinary, the amount, the volume of messaging and the pressures that are on us. So if you can just consider the time that we spend hearing the messaging of consumerism versus the time of hearing that alternative script that Jesus gives us, we're already at a disadvantage, let alone the fact that it appeals to some very, very base instincts of fear and greed that are very difficult to unravel in our behavior. And here are some of the things I believe that this way of living does to us. I think we become fearful people. We fear losing, falling behind, of not being as successful as we should be. We live our lives with this kind of unnamed anxiety that gnaws at us, that makes us restless, that makes us dissatisfied, fearful people. That guy drives a better car, or that woman has better looking children, or I bet they're more successful than I am. I bet he handles himself in a meeting more effectively than me, and that's why he drives a better car than me. We actually think this way. It took me a number of years as I got off of the treadmill that I was on in working in software. Still, when I came to the States, and we actually live in Cupertino, it wasn't Sunnyvale, but I would drive down the 280, and there would be Maseratis and Porsches going by me in my beat-up Subaru, and they'd be going by me on the outside lane, and it took probably 3 or 4 years before my heart actually stopped having this pang when I saw that car, because I thought, that's my car. That was going to be me. And it hurt. And it's at a very, very deep level. I was on this thing that said, this is measures of success can be put down as markers in your life. And I had not got to that point. And it took years for me for that to unravel. Now my beat up Subaru, I'm perfectly fine with it. In fact, you can't drive an expensive car in Santa Cruz, right? Even if you've got money, you have to buy a crappy car. which is one of the reasons I feel so at home there. Anyway, so we become fearful people. The second thing it does, I think, is it enslaves me to devote more of my energy to buying things and less on doing what is actually really important. But it makes me feel like I don't have a choice, right? We set our lives up, we structure them in a way, we gear up our finances, and this mountain of debt enslaves us to a degree of busyness and frantic activity that robs us of Sabbath. And it feels like we have no choice after we've set up we've structured our lives in those ways. Whether that's with our mortgage or the way in which we've just got used to buying lattes or whatever it happens to be, we're on this treadmill that Annie talks about. It robs us of Sabbath, it robs us of joy, of peace, and of a sense of wonder in this world. And then the third thing I think it does to me is that by taking more than I should from the world, I become an instrument of its abuse. And I think that is deeply injurious to the human soul. There's something deeply incongruous about it. We are not wired up to abuse in that way. And piles of this acquired nonsense gets purchased, used a couple of times, and then discarded. And we even pay to store all this stuff that we buy in other places, right? So we buy this stuff, and I drive through towns through the Central Valley, and just go, what do they do here? But everywhere I drive, that you look to the left and the right off the freeway, And there's storage facilities. So people just buy stuff, fills up their house, they have to buy some storage to put it all in. It's absolutely crazy. And as we waken up to the seriousness of God's charge to mankind to rule and to care for the earth, this our participation in this system, I think, causes us a deep sense of grief. And I remember, again, when I first came to America, the act of going into one of these massive shopping malls actually made me feel physically sick. It felt like I was going into a temple to a foreign god, and it was part of the reason why my wife had went through the 2 years of unhappiness was the first 2 years of us coming to America, and she fell into a depression, and part of it was this enormous consumer culture that she was. She actually couldn't go into those large shopping malls. She couldn't go into Target. Now she does, and now we do. But it was actually a real big shock to us. If you've been to any of my workshops, you've probably seen me use this graph before, but this is average per capita income over time. And what happens for the graph to go up and to the right so aggressively as it does is mankind discovers coal. Once they discover coal, then instead of the energy to do any work coming from our muscles or the muscles of an animal, we have this stored energy from millions of years of fossil fuels being created that then gets released. And having released that energy then, we're very, very clever at figuring ways to use it. And so the Industrial Revolution and everything else then follows from that. But what is clear, and you do not have to be very smart to figure this out, this is a finite system, right? This cannot continue to go up in this way, and yet all of our expectations, and I think this may be the first generation that this is not so, but all our expectations up to now has been the next generation will have a higher standard of living than this one. And I'm actually, my wife and I are thinking about what does this mean for our kids and how we bring them up? What are the implications of the massive shift that's just happened since 2008. When I was last here, somebody mentioned this book. I don't know. You did? I got it. It's a really good book. I want to read you just a paragraph from this book. It's called The Great Disruption by a guy called Paul Gilding. And it's on page 4. We, the lucky billion, now spend most of our lives seeking ever greater and subtler refinements in what we perceive to be our quality of life. Nicer clothes, better music, more comfortable furniture, more interesting holidays, more convenient technology, more unusual variations of food, a more secure retirement. It doesn't get much better than this. Our grandparents, let alone the generations prior to them, would look at us in amazement. They would see us living like kings and pharaohs with every convenience dealt with, every basic human need met, and our arguments on what needs to improve, going to ever greater refinements to all this. They would hear us complain about interest rates, not being able to afford a larger house or a renovation, and having a degree of uncertainty that we will be able to live this lifestyle when we stop working. A few generations ago, no one stopped working unless they were dead, let alone spent their latter years in physical comfort with decent health care. Humanity has, on balance, performed extraordinarily well. As we've swept across this world in just 10,000 years, we have established a quality of life for billions of people that was unimaginable at this scale even just a few hundred years ago. Of course, still left behind are many more billions, many of whom live in grinding, soul-destroying poverty. While we strive for larger televisions, DVD screens in our cars and the perfectly grilled tender steak, they die for a glass of water. It's not sustainable. And we know this. We all know this. And part of this book is just putting a name to how this unsustainable way of living, the implications of it. And one of the things Paul says is that part of the financial mess that we are now in is because the borrowing that we've been doing from the future, the debt has now become payable. And things are starting to catch up. And we're all expecting things to turn around and everything to get back to normal, and it's not going to happen. Something fundamentally shifted in 2008. And the American subprime disaster unraveled a whole bunch and exposed a whole bunch of other ridiculous things that were happening all over the world, in Greece and the UK and everywhere, right? And so we've got sovereign debt problems now. But it started with the subprime problem here. The script that we've been given, that we're conditioned to follow, promises to make us happy and keep us safe, but it's failed, and it's failed at every level, and it distorts the image of God in us. And our job as a community that professes to live by this alternative script is to lean so heavily on this alternative script to the one in which we live that our lives are marked by noticeable change. Not to reflect the culture. We are to lean heavily into an alternative script. And I believe this alternative script is profoundly expressed in living simply, giving generously, and buying ethically. I think the more I've thought about this, that there may be other places when you look at the financial aspects of how we are to live, but put those three themes together, and there is so much that we need to unpack in all this. And so I just want to briefly recap over living simply. Life was always intended to be lived in this dependent relationship with the Father, a Father of infinite resources who loves us because we carry his image and who wants to astound us with his goodness. And what we do with our money is we insulate ourselves from that dependency because we don't believe him. We don't believe he'll look after us. We have to look after ourselves. We don't believe, Jesus said, seek first the kingdom, everything else will fall into line. Right? It's not get more balance. I mean, people talk about balance in the church, and I go, how on earth is that a scriptural principle? Where do you get that from? It is not in the Bible. Seek first. You are to be completely sold out. Like, abandon everything. Come and follow me. There is a radical, complete sold outness to Jesus' message. And you know, he looks at the rich young ruler and he loves him, and he's desperately sad that the one thing that he knows he asked that person to do, that person can't do. But consumer Christianity would say, well, wait, before you go on, let's talk about this here. Why don't you just start giving a little bit more than the standard tithe, and then let's just see how it goes. Come in and listen to a nice sermon. But Jesus has this radical thing, and he says, do not worry about your life, what you're going to eat, what you're going to drink. Don't worry about your body, what you're going to wear. Look at the birds. Your Father feeds even the birds. Look at the lilies of the field. These are promises, right? But we don't believe him. And I find this hard myself too, as I've got off of the treadmill and of the income, the massive income drop that we had to deal with. I still do wake up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning in a panic and worried, because just like that Ferrari going past me on the freeway, it's still somewhat hardwired in me to go out and earn more, to get more protection, more of a buffer against a financial disaster. I don't actually believe Jesus when he says, your Father is going to look after you. It's going to be okay. So, living simply, then giving generously. Throughout the Bible, there's this theme of generosity and giving that's first instituted in the Old Testament, in the tithing laws, in the gleaning laws, in the Jubilee. And then in the New Testament, you see it's like the training wheels taken off the bicycle. And there's this instinctive, deeply sacrificial giving that's illustrated in the New Testament. So I won't go through it, through the giving aspect of the Old and New Testament. But because of the toxic nature of money on our souls, this is one of the most important spiritual disciplines that we can get into, is getting into sacrificial giving, not giving on the margins, but giving so that if God doesn't turn up, we're seriously in trouble. If we can get to that level of ratcheting back our income or our disposable income or our lifestyles, we start to push more heavily into this era of turning to our Father and saying, I need you help, your help now. I need your help for the education of my children. I need your help for... we are supposed to live in this dependent relationship with the Father. And then the final one then is buy ethically. So the question for us is, after we've heard what God has to say about our giving, is what about this other 90% or 80% or 98%? We could do so much. The Bible has so much to say about this, but I want to start with the Shema in Deuteronomy 6. And when I've preached on this before, I've actually got a congregation of 6,000 people to stand up, having taken their shoes off, because this is when I grew up in India, and when they would read the scriptures, they would take off their shoes because you're on holy ground. And this is the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. These commandments that I give to you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. In other words, everything that we contemplate, everything we do, the business that is done under the gates of our city, the most intimate relationships in our houses, our commerce, how we conduct affairs. The love of God will cause us to reflect his character of justice, of forgiveness, of grace, of generosity, of patience. Every sphere of our lives is to be an expression of the love of God, of the Father coming in and expressing it through us. But we are so dysfunctional. This is kind of how we behave. This is a board meeting. Before we discuss destroying the competition, screwing our customers, and laughing all the way to the bank, let's begin this meeting with a prayer. I think this is particularly dangerous for Protestant evangelicals. The disconnect between how we live and what we say we believe is almost like this pathological severance in your brain that allows some... What is it? I can't remember what the psychological term is, but people. No, it's what allows a mass murderer to do what they do, and yet to appear to be a nice father or a generous person, right? The complete separation of what you do from what you say you believe, and I think this is particularly bad for Western Protestant evangelicals. If you look at the Jewish faith, you look at the Islamic faith. Or the Buddhist faith, how you live every day is much more closely tied to what you believe. And when we get into this, so if you add to this dysfunction what globalization has done with the lack of transparency in the production of products that we consume, we've got almost the perfect storm, right? We shop based on what we are told is good, which is rational self-interest, and live whole lives with no clue about the effect of expecting to buy a T-shirt for $2.60. Like, that doesn't even go through our mind. What happened that allows me to pick this up for $2.60? Wait, how are people treated? How on earth does this cotton sew itself into this configuration for $2.60? And this is where James 5, I think, is such a disturbing passage for us today. Now listen, you rich people, weep and wail because of the misery that is coming upon you. Your wealth has rotted and moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You have hoarded wealth in these last days. Look, the wages you fail to pay the workmen who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You've fattened yourself in the day of slaughter. You've condemned and murdered innocent men who are not opposing you. And these are the words of the brother of Jesus. This stuff doesn't get preached, by the way. I've only heard this preached on once in my life. And I've heard more sermons than I've had hot dinners. I've grown up a missionary kid and I've listened to a lot of sermons. This doesn't preach in churches. We have to accept this notion that we have incredible wealth, both historically speaking and geographically speaking today as well. And so I think it's very dangerous for us to just write this off as something that was peculiarly appropriate in James's time to what was going on in the Roman Empire. But this sense of inadequacy, this fear of not keeping up, this gnawing regret, this constant, unfulfilled, artificially stimulated desire in us almost defines us. They are toxic to our souls and our bodies, even to the point of mutilating our own flesh in the name of self-worth. And this misery that James speaks of, this is what it is. It's the corrosion of our material possessions that eats our flesh. And perhaps more alarmingly than all of that is James's insistence that this wealth that we think of as being perfectly normal and actually that to which we are entitled, because we are so smart and we work so hard, right, is actually gained in unjust and deplorable ways. That we've actually condemned and murdered innocent people who have had no beef with us. And this is where we're tempted to think, like, James has got it all wrong. But I think, and it's very interesting, having moved to America and seen the difference in the general acceptance of fair trade between the UK and the US. The UK, I think, has a profound awareness at a pretty deep level that the wealth which it has gained has been gained in unjust and deplorable ways. As we've gone around this world and raped and pillaged and built the empire on theft and on the application of violence. There is a deep connectedness of the UK with the rest of the world, because we're this tiny little island. You can't exist just as an island. And there's this history of having got the wealth that we've got by behaving in unjust and deplorable ways. And I think more subtly in America, there isn't that as much international connectedness, and there isn't yet that post-colonial regret and awareness that the wealth that we have is got to be questioned. We actually think this is God's sign that we're a chosen nation, right? We live in this promised land narrative. We don't live in the Babylon narrative here. And so it's very, very deep, a very deep disconnect that has to happen between the church and the state, actually, more and sense of nationhood in America than, oddly enough, has to happen in Great Britain, I think. And maybe we can talk about that later. But I think it's ironic that a lot of Americans think that church and state being married in England is a really bad thing, and we don't do that here. We're very proud of it. Actually, church and nationhood in America is much more closely associated with each other than is initially believed. Anyway, I'm not going to venture into politics. I'd never be successful. And here's the thing. The value of life in the majority world, where people can survive on $2 a day, is very close to zero. If you look at the price of purchasing a human being over the last 400 years, it's just gone off like that. So when slavery was legalized in America, to buy a slave and to have legal title to that slave, it was a big investment, right? You don't just discard something as expensive as that. You make that decision after a long thought and you look after that slave as much as you can. It's a problem for you if the slave gets sick or is killed. Now, the price of purchasing a human being is so low, they are totally discardable, like the cups out here after we've drunk our coffee. It's a completely different dynamic in slavery today, where it is not legalized, and the 6 billion people on Earth today means the price of that human being has dropped dramatically. So these are the countries that we go to for our oil that we burn or turn into plastic, our diamonds, our precious metal that we use in our electronics, our tea, our coffee, our rice, our chocolate. And so, you know, you see a film like Blood Diamond and you see a graphic illustration, I think, of James 5. And if we knew what went on to get us the things that we want, we would boycott practices and companies that behave in ways that we do not believe are reflect our values. I'm not actually into boycotting at all. What Traders One has always tried to do is lift up an alternative way of spending, a different way of thinking about how we should consume that's inspirational and leans more heavily into the biblical script that we're given. So Traders One has been, how am I doing for time? When do we finish here? We do? No, but everyone's going to be walking out in about 15 minutes. Okay, so maybe another 10 minutes or so, 10 or 15 minutes, and then maybe some questions. Okay, well, so Traders One was founded really always to be a partner with the church, to see the church actually take a lead in culture, having understood the alternative script that we're given, and to lean heavily into it. And if you were at the GCC this year, you'll kind of heard my story. I gave my testimony there, so I won't repeat all of that. But having done the stupid thing that my wife and I did in getting off of the hamster wheel and being prepared to move, we thought to India initially. And then there was this one guy actually who spoke at the GCC when I said that we were thinking about moving to India. He like went, as an Indian can, go white, and said, "No, what? Please don't come out here. We have plenty of foot soldiers in the fight for poverty. You must figure out what being a catalyst in your culture needs to be, and go figure that out." So that was actually a prophetic word from Colin Timms, and so we ended up in on the West Coast, but it was definitely against the advice of almost everybody that I spoke to. So for about a year before I moved to the States, when I was traveling on business, and I did a lot of traveling all over the States, I would always slope off and meet an evangelical thought leader, an author, or a missions pastor at a huge church, and kind of say, "The church is not engaged in fair trade in America. Could it be? Is this a good idea?" And every single one of them like just said, "This is a really dumb idea." And it was so clearly put by a pastor at one of the biggest churches in the country. 25,000 people go to this church. And he just looked at me and just said, "Nathan, this will not work, not if you try and build it in partnering with the church, because you need to understand Americans are consumers first and Christians second. Okay? And we understand this, and this is why we have a large and successful church." So in other words, consumer Christianity is the way in which to get bums on seats and get them to give money so that you can sustain this vehicle. Pretty disturbing. So, you know, we moved because God miraculously provided. I was nearly physically sick the day that I went to resign. It was just so difficult for me to do. God turned up in an amazing way and still is providing in the way that he provided. And I told my testimony then at the GCC, but he is still providing for us an alternative income, working part-time still for the software company that I've been working for 14 years. and that has been what's provided for us. But we've had to, as a couple, as a family, had to take a really hard look at what does living more simply, giving generously, and buying ethically mean for us. And some really painful decisions, at least initially, but it has been amazing to walk in this journey with God where income has dropped by 60% at a time when I should be at my peak earning, right, at 45 to 48 or 50. Income has fallen by 50% and had to And we've watched God provide in, like, even the provision of the house that we've got today, the ability to sell our house back in the UK in, like, a three-week window when nothing was moving before or after that. We sold our house within 6 days of putting it on the market at a price we would never have believed we saw it at, and then the window shut on selling houses. And then the house that we were renting from this old 80-year-old guy, the house is 100 years old, there's only been two owners since it was built, and this old guy just said, if you ever want to buy this house, I want to sell to you. And so we came back to him and said, we'd love to buy this house, but this is all we've got. And he goes, well, let's write it up. That's fine. Let's do that. What on earth? Like, aren't your daughter and your son going to be really upset with you? Nah, don't worry about them. I've given them three houses each. They don't need this. I can do whatever I want with this house. And again, this is when I'm almost got myself so worked up and worried. I am not living as Jesus tells me to trust that the Father will provide. And I confess at a time to Kath, I've lost so much money in this Traders One thing that we're on. We'll never get it back. I'm so sorry. The next day, you know, this is what happens. And I go through and I figure out how much money I've wasted in 6 years of Traders One. And it's a big, big number. Like, loss of income, investment in Traders One, all this stuff. That number is exactly the difference between what that guy sold the house to us for and what it was worth. Like, to the dollar. I can't explain it. When we get out of the boat, that's when you start to walk on water. And I am not putting myself up here as somebody who's got tons of faith and, you know, this bold guy for God. But when we start to lean into that narrative, that script that Jesus shows us, God starts turning up in amazing ways. So, we've learned it's been a lot harder to partner with churches than we initially thought it would be. I thought it would be like shooting fish in a barrel. It would be so easy to do this. Really, really hard work. And that's why I treasure the relationship we have here at First Prayers. But we've had to adapt how we go about doing things as we've learned more. Initially, we started, you know, with this event model that you see us do at the GCC. So you turn up with a truckload of stuff with POS machines and take cash checks, credit cards. It's a lot of heavy lifting, right? You can't do that very many times before you collapse in a heap, especially at big churches on the other side of the continent. So, you know, we've learned from having sold a lot of fair trade crafts in that way that it's a cash flow nightmare because you sell 80% of your income comes in the last 2 months of the year. You have to take a complete wild guess at how much you're going to sell, and you either sell out or you end up with too much stuff at the end of the year. It's this real white-knuckle ride, and I didn't have the nerves for it and didn't have the cash for it either because it's capital-intensive. You're paying people up front to make stuff in India and Vietnam and Cambodia. You get it over here, and you hope it sells. So we learned from that. We've also learned that going top-down, like get the senior pastor on board and then get in front of the whole congregation, get them on board, that's great, but you can't expect to do that all the time. You have to create a bottom-up movement that people can somehow partner with you, even in a small group. So we've learned from that. We also learned that you know, the average purchase frequency that people would engage with us on was like 1.3 times. That's how many times the average purchase was. So basically, we turn up to a church, we do this thing, people go, wow, this is great, we'd never thought about connecting our spending with our faith, and this is wonderful, and I can release somebody from human trafficking, I want to buy a bracelet. Well, they buy a bracelet, and that's it. That's all they ever do, for the most part. We might get invited back next year, and we sell another one. But that's about it, 1.3 purchases. So we've changed a lot of what we do. We're not going to completely abandon crafts and, you know, the selling of products that of things like jewelry made by women taken out of commercial sexual exploitation. We won't completely get out of events like the one you see us do at GCC. But we've had to tie our call to action much more closely to this theological imperative of living simply, giving generously, and buying ethically. And figure out what the outworking of that conviction looks like. So what we're doing now is calling people to actually commit to change their everyday items, the the week in, week out, month in, month out purchase of consumables. And so that's where we're going, and I want to explain a bit about the Change for Good program that we've got. Consumables now, having accounted at the beginning for about 5% of income, now account for like 42% of our income now. And it's accelerating as well. And having got people to engage with us in the Change for Good program, which is an outworking, that's the kind of next step after Hungry for Change, we've seen the average number of purchases go from 1.3 to about 4.x something. So people are remaining committed. They're making more purchases. So the change for good program is this. It's a subscription based program where people basically for $1 a day plus shipping. What you're doing is getting a bunch of products that are delivered on a seasonal basis. So you get one box every 3 months, and you can see what the summer box looks like out there. You learn the stories, so you're connected with the producers. You learn the stories behind the products and learn why buying rice from this cooperative in Thailand is a way of proclaiming release to the captive, because it keeps communities together in rural Thailand. If you know what happens when they migrate to the urban slums and they lose their daughters to what happens. So you learn the stories behind the products. There's also a donation component in this. We partner with Food for the Hungry. And you'll see out there, for every box that arrives, that many beans, black beans, are grown by a farmer in the developing world. So you're feeding someone else at the same time as feeding yourself. And you can opt into having coffee options. Not everybody wants caffeine, so it's not a standard part of this. And some people are gluten-free, so we do that. So that's the Change for Good program, and that's where we're going. If you are interested, there are underneath the chairs at the end sign-up forms. All you would need to do is to sign up on that and drop it in the boxes outside, and we can get you signed up to that. But this is really the kind of at the end point of what we're trying to get people to think through. Once you've gone through Hungry for Change and you started to stand in solidarity with the poor, what does it mean now? What do I do on an everyday basis now to build a response to the poor into how I consume? So that's kind of everything that I had to say formally, and maybe I should just throw it open for questions or discussion.
But when those products run out, do you go back to the website and order those individually?
You can do. So every season is different. Right. Well, we would hope you buy them from us. And we put together a... Right. Yep. So, and we put together a kind of bulk purchasing. So if you wanted a box of chocolate or you wanted more of the shampoo, you can buy it on the website and we'll ship it to you. Every season is different, so every single product will be different on each shipment. So you get to, it's not a taster pack. Some people have done kind of taster subscriptions, which I think is a bit of a daft idea. I understand why they do it, but this is like, it's a pound of quinoa that you see, or a pound of rice, and, you know, it's a pound bag of coffee that comes. And so you'll get used to each of these products, and then the hope would be that you would you could purchase from us online after that. Right, the way it works is...
Asking this from a practical...
Yes.
It's a very practical question, because I believe it would benefit from starting it, getting it rolling, and making it opt out.
Yes. Yeah, no, a lot of people have said that. So that's what we've done, and in fact, I had hoped that we had implemented a different thing. So today, if you sign up, you'll get an email... And when you go and click through on that link, it'll ask you to say where you want this stuff shipped to and enter your credit card details. And when you do that, you're basically subscribing. And we will continue to send stuff until you say, hey, I'm done. And you can opt out at any point. But that's the difference. We were, you know, selling whole year subscriptions, and quite a few people bought that. But then after they've bought one quarter or 1 year, they just drop off, which is not the intent.
Okay, that's what I was remembering.
Yeah.
So I think this is a really smart change because it's kind of like, you know, the book club where you have
right.
to, you know,
right.
you have to really make a decision to stop it.
Yep. Right. Yeah, you get recipes. In fact, you said you get a booklet out there, I should have said. So there's a booklet out there. You can see all the summer products in there. So there's recipe ideas as well as the stories behind it and what we're trying to do as a business as well. So it's a kind of little booklet that unpacks some of that stuff. We tried it smaller chunks and more frequent, and what you hit is the percentage of the money you spend going on shipping. So, you know, if you wanted to do $30 every 3 months, the percentage of shipping that chews up that $30 is like 30% of it. And it doesn't become that easy financially. So that's where that's kind of why we've gone to this much longer 3 month thing rather than monthly, and it's why we've kind of tried to pull as many stuff. So it isn't for like a single person wouldn't buy this. It would be for a family.
You know, because I was just thinking that, you know, there should be a way for poor people to opt into doing this kind of thing because we would relate to it.
Mm.
You know, but we can't even afford to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to be in the comment. You know, I do understand mm-hmm. But it's a weird place to be in that we can't really help each other.
Right. And I mean, there is always the option of just saying, buy an 11-pound bag of rice. Like, instead of subscribing to the, you know, it's not like this is the only way. We've got a website with a ton of stuff on there. So you could get together, and when I've gone around to some churches, what they've done is to say, well, for $99, we'll get like three families together and buy this and share out the stuff. Or we're going to get three families together, and we're going to buy all of our olive oil this year, or all of our rice, or whatever it is, from you. It's almost like they're forming their own little co-op, and we supply it. So we've done that. So there is the ability to do that, and you can kind of take a look at bulk purchasing, so you save money that way, and just club together and do it. So there is a way to go down that road.
Can you just quickly summarize some of the places or the factories or whatever it is, the countries that you're helping, where these products are being made?
Where they're coming from?
So can you summarize just what it is good that you're doing, like, and what it's wrong?
Yeah. So the coffee comes, it's a blend, but 75% of it is from Uganda, 25% is Ethiopia. The Ugandan co-op, for example, it's called Marembe Kawamera. 200 Christian, Muslim, and Jewish families living together, farming coffee together, after the conflict of Uganda. It's a really inspirational story. How that community has learned from each other, respects each other, and around economic practices have pulled together and made a real big difference to that whole community. So things like that. The olive oil from Palestine, if you believe there's, I should be using a term like Palestine. But, you know, Palestinian farmers finding a route to market for their olives. Some of these trees are nearly as old as Jesus, right? They're really, really old olive trees that can be traced back from that Roman times. And the olive oil is like, and this is the other thing, when the poor farmers, they can't compete with high volume, low cost expectations. The poor have to retreat into this smaller batch quantities, higher quality. So that's definitely where these foodstuffs are positioned. It's not pile it high, sell it cheap. If you really love chocolate, you're going to love the chocolate. If you really love olive oil, you're going to love this olive oil. It's for people who really appreciate that kind of quality. And the price is what it is because it's done by hand, and it's low quantities and all the rest of it. So those are two examples. I mentioned Thailand. I could go on where the alafia stuff come from and whatever. But
how crazy do you go if you plan, because I'm single, and I would love to participate, especially because of the equivalent meaning donations. So this is not meant to get anything cheap, but I can't use all this that much. So how crazy do you go if I turn it on and turn it off and turn it on and turn it off?
It's fine. It's all automated. I don't mind. Don't want you to turn it off. What some people have done though is say, when I go for a dinner party, I take product. This is a perfect gift hamper, right? So you take this olive oil that will really amaze people, and then you can go and you tell the story at the dinner party of the story of the Palestinian olive oil farmers or the Ugandan coffee. So it's a great way of just having in your pantry. In 3 months, you can get through that many gifts of the stuff that you're not going to eat yourself. So it's pretty easy. And ripping up kitchens and doing them myself, yeah. It's a challenge, yeah. I think one of the things I've learned in the last 4 years anyway is gratitude's an amazing thing. When I never understood joy. I meet with a spiritual director, and I said to him, like, the year that I arrived here, I know I'm meant to feel joy, and I think I could define what it is, but I'm not sure I've ever really experience, or it certainly hasn't been a part of my how I describe life, and I know that there's something deeply wrong if that's the case. So he said, well, if we want to learn about this, then it's going to take at least 12 months, Nathan. We're going to talk about it and get into this. And I found during that year the key to joy was gratitude. I didn't expect it, and I don't think there's any books on it. This is just kind of something I arrived at, because when we are not grateful, we're entitled. We think we're owed things. Gratitude allows you to, it comes from this place of not feeling entitled, of looking at a flower or looking at the beauty in creation and just thinking, this is amazing. And so part of what I've learned in the last 3 or 4 years is and a big part of it is actually living in Santa Cruz, being surrounded by unspeakably beautiful stuff every day, is this life of gratitude. When I can get away from the hecticness of what I'm trying to do and the kind of this treadmill that sometimes you're on and keeping a startup going and having a part-time job on the side and looking after a family and everything else, I can get out and I surf, or I get out into creation. That's when I'm reminded of my Heavenly Father's provision for me, His protection, this amazing beauty, and I feel deeply grateful. I think gratitude more than anything else is what sustains me in doing what I'm doing. I don't feel like I deserve any of the amazing, amazing blessings that I've been given, but I appreciate them. So I think that's probably, if I was going to put my finger on what the fuel is to keep that going, it would be gratitude. Kath works. My 16-year-old actually has a summer job working for us, packing boxes, and I'm teaching them what hard work means. And when we've got the crunch time in November, December, when there's pallet loads of individual boxes going out of the warehouse of internet orders, Yeah, my kids learn what hard work means too.
This is sort of a complicated question, and I'm not quite sure how to ask it, so the reason is I fumble through it. One of the things that I've seen a lot of as I've learned about globalization, as I've learned about the market forces that come to bear from the developed world on the developing world, one of the things that I've seen is this power of outside economies to sort of distort economies in developing worlds. People who realize that they can make more money by selling, by growing coffee or chocolate, go into these luxury goods, and then they end up not growing enough food to sustain their own families. There's a loss of agricultural diversity in these countries as they become dependent on foreign grain. How do you guys, to what extent and in what way are you guys like monitoring what's going on in these countries that you're partnering with to make sure that the stuff that you're doing is actually doing good and not creating these kinds of economic distortions?
It's a great question, and it's above my pay grade. I am not a macroeconomist. But I am aware of that. I do profoundly believe in job creation as a way to break cycles of dependency and poverty. So I start from that principle. Secondly, we do not go in and say, hey, why don't you convert all of this stuff into coffee trees? Because I could pay you X or you could earn X. I mean, that's not how we work. We get behind and you know, maybe at some point we're big enough to be able to afford to bring on somebody with a big brain who could go into these places and go without destroying, you know, centuries of tradition and whatever. And I think we could do this in this area, and let's find some resources to be able to get them to move into this area so that we can create a market for their product. I mean, maybe we'll get there. That's not where I'm at. Where I'm at right now is we find mature businesses that have proven themselves to have very redemptive stories given to communities, and when we buy from them, in the belief that I aid doesn't fix stuff. It is necessary in some places for short periods of time, but the only thing that fixes these things are jobs that are dignified and that give a living wage. That's about as high a pay grade as I can get to.
The 2008 disaster, didn't that affect the ability to grow this? Because people just don't feel like they have the money?
Yes and no. Whole Foods is still doing pretty well, but you know, they took a big hit, I think, at the time. I think there's enough people out there that both buy these kind of products and would align themselves to the principles of what we're trying to teach behind them, for me not to whine about 2008 really put a damper on our growth. I don't blame that. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, Nathan. Let's close in prayer. Dear Lord, we're just grateful for new insights, new understanding, renewed care and concern, conviction in areas that we once thought were simple, that it was that person, it was or that person over there. And thank you for touching our hearts. And we pray that you'll continue to strengthen Nathan in the work you've given him to do, and bring alongside him those who will help. And somewhere along the line, maybe a brainiac that will even take it to another level. But whatever it is, we just pray that your will be done, that we will seek your kingdom, your rightness, and trust you for all the rest. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. I have one announcement. We do have some more of these five-day packets. In case you haven't signed up, in case you would like to enter into this grand adventure of 5 days of grains, lentils, rice, oatmeal, The oatmeal was really, really good. Carolyn, you can put a little honey on it, and Carolyn was questioning the amount of honey I was putting on. but we do have some in the back, and Sherry will be happy to sign you up. Okay, thank you. Yes. Yeah.